This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Lisa McCormack about the cultural sociology of art and music, new directions and new discoveries. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm sort of fascinated and also sort of enthused by this book, partially because of what the title says, actually, you know, new directions and new discoveries. And it sort of struck me as a really, you know, sort of significant agenda setting book in the study of art and music, and actually kind of culture slightly more generally. And I'm interested in what inspired the collection, where I guess kind of your role as editor came from, and why you decided to put together this collection.
Sure. Well, this started off as a special issue for the American Journal of Cultural Sociology. I was invited to guest edit an issue on art and music, and I received so much interest and so many great proposals that after putting together this special issue, I invited some of the people who submitted to put together this edited collection with me. And I'm so pleased with how it came about, because I think it really does make a case for greater diversity in the kind of approaches we take to studying artistic objects and artistic endeavors.
I mean, that thing of artistic objects, artistic endeavors is really crucial, I think. And the book, I suppose, saying the book is kind of critical of how we do the sociology of art and culture is maybe the wrong framing, but I guess the book says, actually, there are a whole other set of ways we could be thinking about the sociology of art and music and art and culture. And one of those, obviously, is with this framing of cultural sociology. And you talk in the book, and I know some of your other work has been involved in this cultural sociology approach called the Strong Program. And I guess it'd be useful to clear a bit of ground by saying what that is and where this collection relates to that specific approach in cultural sociology.
Yes, well, the Strong Program is a particular theoretical commitment. Basically, the differentiation that's being made there to the sociology of culture has to do with whether or not you see culture as relatively autonomous. So a Strong Program approach thinks that you can't avoid meaning. It thinks that culture can be a causal force. It doesn't want to relegate culture to being something that's a dependent variable, something that just is driven by social structure. Instead, it develops different tools and analytical approaches to understand how meaning works and how meaning drives people and shapes the world that we live in.
I guess the question that comes from that then is what's the sort of the newness, you know, what are the new directions, new discoveries with regard to applying the Strong Program? Because obviously it's got a very long and very sort of prestigious history as a way of doing sociology. So why were you thinking in terms of new directions and new discoveries?
Indeed. Well, in some ways, it was a new approach in 2006 when I co-edited Myth, Meaning, and Performance with Ron Eierman. That's when we were really trying to carve out a new path for a cultural sociology of the arts. This is in many ways the sequel that's marking a new stage in that. It's kind of coming of age and making sure that this approach, this cultural sociology approach, is put into conversation with other perspectives that also attend to meaning, because these are kind of scattered about in the field. So I felt that it was time to bring this together and put them into conversation. Because in thinking about what's happened in cultural sociology and sociology of the arts since Myth, Meaning, and Performance came out in 2006, in some ways, a lot has changed, but in a lot of ways, nothing has changed. I feel like there have been so many theoretical developments in cultural sociology, things like the iconic turn, which is extremely relevant to the arts. But cultural sociologists have continued to gravitate towards topics and areas that are non-artistic. They really focus on things like politics and trauma and things like that. Whereas the sociology of the arts has also developed. There's far more about creative industries now than putting sociology of the arts in dialogue with history of art or music sociology, which was the conversation in the 1990s into the turn of the century. And yet, there's still a lot of depending on Bourdieu and Becker. And these are perspectives that were developed in the 20th century to speak to how art was done and made and thought about in the 20th century. And I feel like a lot has moved on. There is more that we can be doing. We have had several calls to bring meaning and the artwork back into sociology of the arts. So why don't we just get on with it already? And so that's why I was assembling people who in different ways have been doing this and have been attending to meaning, but perhaps haven't been as aware of each other as they should have been, and perhaps haven't been engaging as directly with the Strong Program as they could be.
Yeah, and I think that gives a really nice overview of the rationale for what's going on with the chapters. There's a line somewhere in your introduction where you talk about bringing a kind of cultural approach to cultural objects. And I think that summary of, you know, on the one hand, Strong Program sociology has been getting involved in, I guess, kind of, you know, non-cultural topics, as you outline, or non-art and culture topics. And at the same time, you know, so much of that kind of sociology of culture tells you, you know, things about taste and social position, or, you know, patterns of discrimination in the cultural workforce or whatever. And there is this kind of lack of, I guess, kind of sense of, as you describe, meaning. And one of the ways that the book opens and kind of gets into this, and you've sort of alluded to this already, is by doing a bit of kind of agenda setting early on. And the first three chapters, I was struck by the way that you've got a chapter that tries to develop the idea that, you know, French sociology of art and culture is more than just Bourdieu. You've got a chapter that says actually actor network theory, you know, which has been one of the big, I guess, kind of movements in sociological theory since the 1980s, that can be really, really useful for understanding the sociology of art and artists. And also we can apply this cultural approach to think about things like art market scandals. So for that first section of the book, what were you trying to get the authors to do, and what were you trying to bring together when you were thinking about setting new agendas?
Well, the first chapter that sets these new agendas is more of an overview to try to understand how we got here in the first place. So I was delighted that Natalie Haenick, who is an absolute giant in the field of the sociology of art, could give us her take on how at least in France, the sociology of art evolved. So she takes us through three generations and shows us all kinds of twists and turns in how this field developed, also explains to us how the field started in the first place, and takes us through these developments, telling English speakers, people who maybe aren't able to read in French, about all kinds of studies and all kinds of debates that we perhaps have not been sensitive to in Anglo sociology. So that chapter was important to me because it shows that for some time now, there has been a call for a more interpretive approach. And in Natalie Hainick's case, it's inspired very much by Norbert Elias, but it's trying to provide the counterpoint to the critical empirical perspective that Bourdieu pioneered, and to which we're very grateful, because had it not been for him, we wouldn't have a sociology of art in France as we know it. But there has been so much more that she's been trying to develop alongside other scholars in pragmatism, for example, who have found other theoretical resources and other sorts of methods to use to try to understand what motivates people to not dismiss their beliefs just as illusions, and to explain everything away in terms of social position or domination. So that, I thought, kind of sets things up to say that there's always been more theoretical diversity than we might even have realized. Then in the next chapter, Roberts and Strandvad look at the existing approaches to studying artist residencies. They don't want to dismiss the art world's approach. They don't want to dismiss Bourdieu. And they certainly want to harness everything that actor network theory can do for them. But they also find that it doesn't take them far enough. And this is what I found really exciting about this chapter, is that they found this feature of artistic life. Artist residencies are incredibly numerous. They're all over the place. They are important for artists and artist development in pretty much every artistic discipline. And yet they're very difficult to study. They're very difficult to analyze. And all of the perspectives that we have to hand come up short. So they're trying to find a way to combine the strengths of existing perspectives, but also enrich that by moving beyond them to bring in ideas such as creative ecologies. So part of the chapter, I think, is very generous in its orientation, and that's one of the reasons why I think it fits well with what I was trying to achieve with the volume, is that it's acknowledging that actor network theory hasn't traditionally done terribly well at acknowledging inequalities. They want to see how it can do better by being combined in very specific ways with a critical sociology. And yet even that isn't quite enough to reach into the creative process, into how objects are created by artists, but also to see how this existence in a purely artistic sphere relates beyond the artistic sphere, to think about things like how a pandemic affects an artist's livelihood as well as creative potential. And then we have in Amy Whitaker and Fiona Greenland's chapter a tour de force, theoretically, that's generating new concepts, such as the financial simulacrum, and also combining ideas from the Strong Program, things like social performance of the artistic of the art dealer, to try to understand a new kind of scandal. So they show that in the sociology of art, we've thought a lot about scandal in the arts, but it's usually to do with how artists shock audiences through the art itself. And they're noticing that more recently, as art has become financialized, there's kind of a new potential for a new sort of scandal. And so they choose a specific case because it brings to light all kinds of significant changes in how art is bought and sold. And I am particularly excited about this idea about artworks having a kind of dual status or a dual nature, so that it exists both in this financial realm, where it has a kind of commercial value, but it also has this artistic nature, where it's critical praise and what it means to artists and to aficionados gives it a different sort of hermeneutic value. And so their argument is that the commercial value is actually rooted in its non-market value, that it's only because it has artistic meaning that an artwork can have financial value. But in contemporary society, where now art is an asset class and you have all kinds of shareholders, it creates this different relationship between the buyers and the artwork. Shareholders don't have to know each other, let alone anything about art. And it creates this kind of new space where you need a dealer who can manage going in between the artistic world and the financial world. It demands a certain kind of person with certain kinds of characteristics, but it also opens up opportunities like we see with the Philbrick case, where things go horribly wrong.
Obviously, meaning is really central in that chapter's analysis, and the second section of the book really opens that out. It's called What Art and Music Mean, and the chapters within that, I think there are particularly two chapters that I found kind of most interesting, but obviously feel free to pick out your own examples within this. At root, I think all four of them are grappling with this question about how do artists and organizations understand, think about the meaning of what it is that they're doing. So you've got a chapter about what artists think is the meaning of art. There's a chapter about questions of diversity and how it's constructed in American classical music. There are perspectives from migration studies. And there's a chapter about how critics kind of both make meaning for themselves, for artists, and for their publics as well. And I suppose that the broad question I'd like to tease out from this section is this idea about what do artists, critics, musicians think is the kind of the meaning of what it is they do, and how do those four chapters really tell us an answer to that question?
Well, they tell us in different ways. So what I liked about both Alexander Sutton's chapter and Anne Mullen's chapter is that they're talking to the artists themselves and listening to the debates that artists and musicians have about what they do. And they're actually investigating that and taking it seriously. So this has been kind of a blind spot in the sociology of art. There's been all kinds of looking at reception studies, all kinds of looking outside of the actual relationship between the artist and their artwork, and not enough talking to the artists and the musicians about what it is they think they're doing. And especially in Alexander Sutton's case, I think it's quite fascinating how he's finding in their discussions and their struggles to really contend with social justice issues. There has been a history in American art music that they're in conversation with, that they are very sensitive to, and so it's not like all of a sudden, out of nowhere, classical music has started to recognize that there are diversity issues. In different ways, different generations have been trying to contend with this aesthetically as well as socially. But now, since the murder of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, this has become more urgent than ever. And so he's tracing the different initiatives and the different approaches that these organizations and these individuals take in actually trying to make art, music matter for their time. And Ann Mullen is investigating the same kind of urgency of relevance, but by talking to artists about why they think their or how they think people actually engage with their art, and she finds that they're not only interested in how viewers of art decode it. They're quite sensitive to the fact that not everybody has an art history education, but they don't think that viewers who aren't necessarily well-versed and immersed in art history won't get what they're doing. They'll engage with it differently. They might engage with it viscerally in a more kind of sensuous manner, but that doesn't diminish at all what they are trying to get through to their viewers. They're also hoping that the art kind of engages with issues that are kind of that emerge through the art itself. So even if the artwork isn't necessarily what the person is responding to, there might be ideas that are triggered and that maybe even take the person out of their everyday experience. That to artists is an achievement. But it's not like the section forgets that part of artistic discourse is influenced by critics. This is what's fantastic about Hannah Wall's approach, is that she's done this very systematic study of critical discourse in the main art newspapers and journals in the United States to see how it is that critics contend with contemporary art that's always polyvocal, very ambiguous in its meaning, and yet there are very, very kind of common devices that critics use, not in a prescriptive way, but more in kind of a suggestive way, to guide or suggest ways to interpret these very complex works, and this, I think, helps to explain why so many of us enjoy reading reviews so much. I've confessed to Hannah that I'm constantly reading reviews of exhibitions and films that I'll never be able to see because it's in another city or I'm unable to make it. But there's something about the writing that is just so so amazingly done, so exciting, and so aesthetic in itself. And that's what she's really getting to, is how they're using metaphors, how they're using different devices in describing the work and interpreting the work, but not in this really rigid, prescriptive way. Whereas Varvara Kobishta is really engaging with migrant artists in a new way, in doing interdisciplinary work in a very exciting and inventive way, trying to bring migration studies into conversation with cultural sociology. She's found this resonance in the way that art and migration scholars talk about artists who are in this kind of situation, and the way that cultural sociology has talked about the agency of art, and in teasing out the different trajectories that that migrating artists are going through simultaneously. Some of these are through geographic space. Sometimes it's about migrating through aesthetic space, and how these do not always align, but how artists can turn to a variety of resources, some of them actually artistic, not only professional, not only financial, some of them purely artistic, to make sense of their new situation in their new home, adopted home, that non-artists might not have available to them. And that involves some very sophisticated interdisciplinary thinking.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I mean, that, I suppose, geographical perspective comes through in the third section of the book, which is really engaging with the places where art and music happens. So there's a chapter about art galleries, which had a particularly interesting theoretical perspective, actually, and was quite, you know, sort of left field, both in terms of thinking about gallery space, but also in terms of the sociology of the gallery. There's a chapter about music venues. And then intriguingly, there's a bit, you know, like thinking about migration studies and cultural sociology, there's a chapter that tries to engage with what's going on with the aesthetics and economics of musicians and contemporary music in Japan. And again, you know, to try and distill all of that into a single answerable question is an impossible task. But I'm going to ask you anyway, where does, I guess, kind of place fit then in this new directions and new discoveries for cultural sociology?
Well, what I love about this section is that it answers that each in a different way. So Laura Harris is thinking about the city, but she is thinking about the gallery in the city. And she's really thinking about the materials of the gallery, particularly the windows, and how these are all part of what is said in an exhibition, but also what visitors to an art gallery are responding to. And so she's really building on ideas of atmosphere and how this is created through materials, through glass, through the way that light is filtered, and that this is a huge component of what is creating meaning in and outside of the gallery. So that is perhaps a way to think about that is the gallery in the city, whereas with Picot's article, it's the city. It's all of the music venues in the city. So I think we're going from slightly more specific to the space of a whole city and how the different music venues relate to each other. This one I relate to very much as a musician, because I've had to think about how to modify what I do and how to do it more effectively as a cellist, depending on what kind of space I'm playing in. And Picot has had some very exciting access to bookers, who are the people who engage the musicians to play concerts in spaces, but sometimes come up with really creative ideas about what kind of performer or what kind of ensemble would work well in a space where they don't normally play. And there are all kinds of aesthetic gambles that happen through these experiments. Some of them are one-offs. Some of them are genre, like, groundbreaking. and they generate incredible excitement that then becomes embedded in the city as a new kind of aesthetic musical experience that generates even further experiments. So this involves, again, some very sophisticated theoretical acrobatics, thinking of the field, a Borghesian field in Paris. But this is combined with the strong program to think about why some concerts worked and other concerts didn't. And she combines a kind of multiple correspondence analysis to give us this field context, but then an ethnographic investigation of a few selected concerts to show us when the elements of performance come together in this hugely creative way and click and work and fuse with the audience. The last chapter is different yet because it's thinking about a space of performance, not a particular place of performance, but a kind of genre of concert, which is the salon. And these are important to Japanese musicians, which is a puzzle for sociologists because they don't actually make much money by putting on a salon concert. They actually have to spend their own time and resources putting together their own salon concert. So Beata Kowalczyk uses a strong program approach, thinks about this in terms of social performance to investigate how it is that this particular setting, this particular occasion creates a conducive mise-en Sen for musicians to be able to be the kind of musicians they always wanted to be and perform this ideal performance of European classical music to the sort of audience they had in mind and performing the kinds of programs they'd always had in mind during their studies and early career.
The final section is probably the most eclectic, partially because you've got such a wide range of different perspectives. You know, you've got stuff about intellectual property and law, stuff that I guess, you know, draws on ideas from politics, you know, possibly even sort of political science in the case of thinking about democracy and democratization. You've got a really fantastic historical example of jazz in Czechoslovakia, as was, and then a discussion of, I guess, a kind of an emergence of almost a new field in the context of art and research. And this section, I suppose a good question to sort of synthesize what's going on is, how did you synthesize what's going on? How did you bring together these four quite distinctive and quite eclectic chapters into this final section of the book?
The thread really was controversies of different kinds. So the controversy in Meredith Hall's chapter is over a racial slur that was chosen as a name for a rock band, a popular music dance band. And they decided to trademark it, and this became this major court case. It just kind of escalated, and it became this huge public debate over whether someone should be able to own a racial slur. So we had a debate that was sparked by musicians and a musician who emerged from the field of popular music to present himself as this great hero, civil hero, who was protecting or advancing the rights of minority and calling out American institutions for treating minority communities differently, with some unintended consequences, which Meredith Hall goes into very, very well. But this was one kind of controversy. I liked that there were so many different kinds of controversies. Dominik Zielinski's controversy is one that he had to to show you that there was more controversy. So everyone has assumed that jazz in Stalinist Czechoslovakia was denigrated because it was American, but he shows us that it was never as simple as that, and that there was actually quite a lot of debate about whether jazz should be seen as the music of the proletariat, not as the music of the dying class. So there he's helping us to understand, first of all, why that that controversy arose in the first place, why it created so much trouble for the kind of Stalinist cultural sphere, how it is that jazz became so unclassifiable for musicians and cultural agents of the time, and why we've been so quick to assume that this was a simple case in more recent times. So this was very much a non-obvious, it's not what you think kind of article, which I always particularly enjoy. And it's also an excellent example of a strong program hermeneutic, structural hermeneutics, where you can uncover the cultural logic of a society or of a group and show how it is that that logic is attempting to be used to understand an artistic practice, but here coming into trouble because of its internal inconsistencies. Alison Gerber's article, chapter on is about controversy in a different way. It's about a scandal as well, because it starts off by pointing out a shocking occurrence that happened when a PhD in artistic research was. A PhD candidate in artistic research failed their doctoral defense, and this was earth-shattering in Swedish society, because this had never happened before, and it was actually front-page news, and discussed far beyond the art world. Why was this allowed to happen? How could this happen? And it really drew attention to this field of research, which is artistic research, which exists well beyond Sweden. It's a global phenomenon, but here too, there's a kind of difficulty and contestation around the boundaries of it. What exactly is artistic research? Is it art? Is it research? And what do they mean by artistic research? So what Alison Gerber does is come up with different ways to understand how these boundaries are negotiated, because for a lot of people involved in this field, the boundaries aren't important. And so she's curious why they are sometimes important and how those are navigated when they are made to become important. And finally, the closing article, the grand finale by Nancy Weiss Hanrahan, is I think a hugely important intervention for our time, because it's really getting at the question of whether all of these incredible technologies and all of these the digitization of music and art is actually democratizing it, because there is a sort of assumption in a lot of discussions about the digital age and what this makes accessible to people, there is this assumption that that's necessarily better and that's necessarily more democratic. But she is really challenging us to think about whether it is. And she's doing this by revisiting earlier debates about music and democracy, so that we can get out of our kind of presentist assumptions. It kind of wakes us up to how this sort of issue was discussed in earlier moments of time, and maybe makes us start asking different questions about the grounds upon which we are debating this, to notice how sometimes this discussion starts to sound an awful lot like libertarianism. And so she wants to challenge us to think about whether we really are fostering a critical discourse, but also a kind of infrastructure in our media outlets that allow us to think about social issues and the meaning of music in our time.
You've given an incredible summary of some of the themes and ideas in the various chapters. And, you know, it's really just a sort of starting point. And I really sort of strongly urge people to buy the book, to read the book as a book, as well as engage with the individual chapters. And given, you know, the sort of scale of the achievement, it seems sort of a bit of a mean question to finish with by asking, well, what are you going to do next? Because, you know, the amount of sort of work to bring this collection together is really clear. But I suppose the book, in offering new directions and new discoveries, has it sort of given you a new research agenda? Are you at a point where you're like, well, actually, you know, I've sort of settled some accounts with a cultural sociology approach and might do something different? Are there, you know, possible new research collaborations that have come from the book for you? What happens next?
Well, putting this book together was a total labor of love. I enjoyed it so much. And these authors have just been incredible, rising to the occasion, being so creative and responsive and generous in how they approached the work. So it's really been an amazing journey, as they say. But really, just getting to know them all so much better and to work with them on this, I really feel like it was a collective endeavor that maybe I was instigator, but we accomplished this together. And I'm so proud of what we have done. So I really hope people are going to engage with it. And I hope they are stimulated to try out some new ideas and to explore some avenues that they might not have otherwise. There is such a range of topics and also geographic places and issues that we're engaging with, but I never pretended for one second that this was a comprehensive handbook. I know there are a lot of parts of the field that we were not engaging with. I think there are some potential links to emerging areas in sociology of the arts, and I certainly look forward to exploring that and seeing that explored in the field. In terms of what I'm doing next, I'm certainly continuing to explore how a cultural sociology of music can be done. I personally am working on exploring the iconicity of musical instruments to think about how musical instruments become iconic objects. I'm drawing on some of the ideas from the edited collection for this, especially Fiona Greenland and Amy Whitaker's idea of this dual nature of the artwork. In fact, we could say that musical instruments have a triple nature. They have this commercial aspect, especially fine musical instruments, especially fine musical stringed instruments. They're worth hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars. So there's that, but they are also works of art themselves. They are aesthetically pleasing, beautifully put together, but they're also heritage objects, which is why they wind up in museums, which is why they're preserved and people are concerned about their long-term preservation. So that's one avenue I am researching, how these objects come to have such discursive depth, pardon me. So that's one avenue and I'm exploring, but I'm also considering a new issue in contemporary musical life, which is the Russian invasion of Ukraine and how this has affected cultural institutions that promote internationalism. So especially international competitions in classical music. So this is building on my earlier work on classical music competitions. A lot has changed since my book came out in 2015. There's a lot more to do with digitalization of classical music competitions, of music competitions generally, and the pandemic has definitely accelerated these changes and raised a lot of questions about how that should be done. But the Russian invasion of Ukraine is another sort of challenge and earthquake-like change, which is making these institutions think about their commitment to civility and whether that involves condemnation of Russia or whether that involves the banning of Russian and Belarusian competitors. So I'll be comparing how different cultural institutions have responded to this both in music but also in sports. So specifically, I'll be comparing the response of the World Federation of International Music Competitions to the International Olympic Committee, because they had at the initially completely opposite reactions to what was happening, but gradually the International Olympic Committee has been moving closer to what the World Federation of International Music Competitions has done, which is to say that Russian individuals should not be discriminated against, and it's the regime that should be challenged.